This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 7th of October 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
There was no punches thrown. There was no face slapping, there was no digs, there was nothing. It was, as you know, people in Hull would term as, you know, handbags at dawn.
The sort of week in British politics in which a UKIP MEP getting hospitalised by a policy meeting is only about the fifth stupidest thing which has happened. Monocle's Steve Bloomfield, Ed Stocker and Henry Rhys Sheridan will be here to discuss that and the week's other silliness, including Donald Trump's preparation or lack thereof for the upcoming second presidential debate and the brisk lesson learnt by a group of Australian Formula One fans about how to behave abroad. Lesson one, don't use the host nation's flag as underwear. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's executive editor, Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker, and Monocle 24 researcher, Henry Rhys Sheridan. And in a late addition to the program, Monocle 24's executive producer, Tom Edwards. And welcome all to the program, the first portion of which we shall devote to an extended discussion of a week in which Britain has resembled a nation which has drunk two bottles of white wine on an empty stomach. By way of brief recap, the government proposed compelling British firms to publish lists of foreign workers. The opposition unleashed a shadow cabinet containing several members who make Caligula's appointment of his horse to the Senate look a model of relative sanity. UKIP had an actual fight in the Strasbourg Parliament, and possibly not coincidentally to all of the above, the pound crashed to the extent that it is now trading on international exchanges somewhere between otter pelts and small, smooth, red, flat rocks. I'm reminded, I'll ask you first, Steve, of the heady days of summer in which every time you looked at the news, something else completely ludicrous had happened, and we spent days and days frantically rewriting scripts which were out of date as soon as we'd recited them.
Yes, that was... Look, that was fun compared to this, because at least that was just... That was just strange politics. It's like, oh my God, Boris Johnson isn't going to stand. Oh my God, who's Andrea Leadsom? What she said about families? This has turned... nasty this week. Let's not forget what happened at Tory party conference. Theresa May's government, in the period of 24 hours, suggested that companies should list their foreign workers, told foreign doctors that they won't be needed in a decade's time, but thanks anyway, and refused to guarantee EU nationals currently living in the UK the right to remain. In fact, actually, Liam Fox, the Minister for International Trade, rather gleefully said, this is our main card, of course we're not going to give it away. So it has been, an interesting week where the sort of the true colours of what Brexit actually means have shone through. And indeed, in the last couple of hours, we've heard this bizarre story about the London School of Economics, which, as you would imagine, has a number of international staff. The LSE is often asked by the government to help out, to advise on certain policies. They've been asked to help out to advise on Brexit, but have been told... under no circumstances should anyone who is not British be on any of these teams.
British facts for British people. There is some suggestion now that either this was a misunderstanding to begin with, or that having been rumbled, the LSE and or the Foreign Office are furiously trying to row back from it, which is a dynamic we've seen a few times this week. Tom Edwards, what are we learning about the kind of nation that post-Brexit Britain will be?
Andrew, we're going to hell in a handcart. I'm tired of being mealy-mouthed around this. And the reason is that there's a carnival of cretins in frontline politics everywhere across the spectrum. A pathetic assortment of sort of intellectual pygmies. And it doesn't matter where you look. And indeed, there's the problem. Steve mentioned what's happening at the Tory conference, and that's because some particularly unlikable elements have carte blanche. They've got absolute freedom. They could literally say anything, and they're coming close to doing it, and know that they're going to be untroubled. Indeed, they'll probably increase their polling numbers, and they're certainly not going to worry about what's going to happen before 2020. There's utter disorder, there's chaos in all of politics. I cannot recall in my kind of adult lifetime as depressing a period in politics as we're in now. And people might say, well, hang on, you're flying off the handle. Brexit hasn't even happened yet. And indeed, that's one of the problems. A lot of people are genuinely coming out and saying, hey, look, Brexit vote, everything is fine. Okay, the pound's lost a bit of value, but nothing else has happened. It's not even going to... It hasn't happened yet. It's not going to happen for 2 years.
European Union.
We're still there. That's why everything's fine. It's because it hasn't changed yet. But simple facts, the statements of the obvious, are now, I don't know. I don't know what is going to... I dread to think what's going to happen next.
Facts are a very, very 20th century concern, Tom.
Can I just add something here?
Please.
Which is that there was a very interesting piece by Gabby Hinsliff in today's Guardian, where she pointed out that actually a lot of what has been said that is... at first glance racist and at second glance definitely racist is being said by people who aren't. So she mentions Jeremy Hunt, who, you know, his wife is Chinese. He's an internationalist. He's actually, you know, he was talking just a few months ago about how Brexit would be damaging for the NHS. She also talks about Amber Rudd, who's the Home Secretary, she's a liberal former journalist. And what she suggests is that actually this isn't a cabinet of racists. Instead, she says it's a cabinet peppered with people terrified of being exposed as closet liberal elitists, clumsily second-guessing what people they'd once have regarded as racist actually think.
Well, who are we pandering to then? The lowest common denominator.
Well, you say it's the lowest common denominator.
Somewhere you get to the point where someone who actually is racist and is full of vitriol.
The thing is, it's not the lowest common denominator. Look, around this table it is, yes, of course, because we're all like, this is ridiculous. But actually the polling on listing of foreign workers, sadly, polls very, very well indeed.
What impresses me about all this is that obviously we're very into nation branding here at Monocle. And in spite of the fact that these mess-ups are coming from a very disparate range of actors, they're an absolute lockstep. I mean, we're presenting an extremely coherent brand here. The hard-nosed thuggery on display in the European Parliament is aesthetically at one with the listing of foreign workers' names. And I think that's something to be proud of.
Can we talk about the thuggery? We will get to the thuggery, but there has been kind of this recurring motif of the political nonsense that's consumed this country in the last few months becoming sort of creating its own instant metaphors. How long was it after Britain voted to leave the European Union that England got beaten up by Iceland at the European Championships? It was a matter of hours.
I think
hours,
it was just before the Houses
of
Parliament
days.
Started to fall into the River Thames. Somewhere
yeah, literally started to crumble.
Ravens leaving the edifice.
I mean, on Henry's point about brand Britain there, we should bring in Ed Stocker from the other side of the Atlantic. Ed, has this yet reached the point at which Americans are tuning in to British news and clutching their sides and laughing?
Ed doesn't think that's the case.
He's literally been rendered speechless.
He has literally been rendered speechless.
But isn't that a good point, Andrew? How often have we talked? We've poked fun at America's, I'm not exactly going to say love affair with Donald Trump, but the fact that he is a serious candidate and still now, you know, he could win the presidency. And yet, you know, is it a more edifying spectacle to look at UKIP, I'll say politicians loosely, literally duking it out in the street?
There was, we're an international office with a sort of office where if we had to list our international workers, it would take rather a long time.
We would need to publish an extra supplement.
A lot of them are long names, that's why.
Indeed. Also, actually, just while we're on the subject, it's like, as this is a company that was set up and owned by a foreigner, does this then count against it? Do we actually have to list the British people? This should be a plus, shouldn't it? I think here
it would be quicker to list the British people.
Anyway, let's leave that aside. It is interesting talking to people in this office about this story, about the foreign workers listing thing, for example, has gone around the world. One of our Spanish colleagues was loudly reading out a headline from El País. Someone else pointed out this is in an Indian newspaper as well, and not in a good way. You know, this is really a story. You know, it's one of those things that has been raised and probably will be dropped because it's stupid and businesses say it's stupid and we're not going to do it. But it's too late. This has already been heard all around the world.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is, in terms of the feasibility of actually executing this as policy, it's difficult to imagine that they ever thought that this would be executed. And, you know, I'm also unsure as to what kind of, I think you were mentioning this as well upstairs, Andrew, you know, what kind of people this measure is meant to appease, what they would do with the information when they had it. And, you know, particularly when you think about firms in London, you know, so almost every firm employs dozens of foreigners. And I'm just not sure if that's what, if they're aware of that, the government are aware of that, first of all, and if that's what they had in mind when they...
I don't know what they had in mind. I never... What were people supposed to do? Put up a list on the front door? I
mean, but isn't this the problem, Andrew? This is talk... We often talk about, oh, you know, politics is... Politics struggles with the short-termism of its protagonists. And, you know, we have a cyclical process. People just worry about winning the next vote. Can they stay around for one parliament or whatever? We saw with Brexit, some of the key protagonists in that and antagonists, it's pretty well acknowledged now, probably didn't want the outcome that they were ostensibly campaigning for, or they certainly didn't anticipate it. But we were in this lunatic cycle where people were chasing their tails and you had the likes of Boris Johnson campaigning. One can only really imagine because he was thinking of his own political, personal political interests. So the idea that politicians or the political class or the people who come up with these ideas are actually considering, you know, how it would be implemented. I think the Brexit vote proves that they just don't think about that at all. Clearly, nobody really thought, including Farage, UKIPers, or the Tory pro-leave camp, none of them really thought about what would happen. And this is exactly why we're facing such a profound problem.
It's quite terrifying, isn't it? For the first time, I feel that I'm in a rudderless ship. Before, it may have been rudderless, but I was...
You weren't around for the major years, were you?
Well, the thing is, I was at least comfortable in the illusion that there was a captain.
I just want to make one point about this as well, which is that what was particularly striking about this week was that, you know, 48% of the country voted to remain. And of the 52% who voted to leave... you know, quite a lot of them, it had nothing to do with immigration. Those people, their views seem to have been completely put to one side. And it was particularly intriguing to see Theresa May, who had voted Remain, had backed Remain publicly, just about, essentially making herself the lead spokesperson now for Leave Britain, and essentially smearing the rest of us. I use that word, you know... You know, correctly, I think, smearing us all as essentially liberal elitists who can just shut up and get on with it, which was a curious way of essentially talking about half the country.
Speaking myself as an out and proud liberal elitist, I think it is fair to wonder who speaks for me at this point. And Tom, I'll ask you, how much contribution to the current madness is being made by the fact that the Labour Party appears to have given up on the idea of ever actually governing again?
Well, this is, I think, what I was talking about in my, you know, wild rant that I went on earlier about the fact that the Tories are operating in a consequence-free environment. Yeah, I mean, Labour has quite explicitly positioned itself as a party governed now by, you know, a much more sort of aggressively left-wing ideology. And they've also been explicit in making it clear to the public, and indeed to the, Steve will remember the number, the actual many millions of people who voted Labour and would vote Labour in an election, which is it 6 million or something?
It's a lot less than it was.
It's many fewer than it used to be. But they've made it explicitly clear that they are not interested in affecting meaningful political change by getting into office and having a programme. Ideology comes first and foremost, beyond anything, and that what matters is being true to that ideology and true to the rank and file, which is now a big number, I think 500,000 or more members, which make it possibly the biggest political party in Western Europe or some such.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
But, you know, and it comes back to this old, much more fundamental thing, which is, are you in politics to adhere to an ideology, or are you there to try and affect some kind of change? And until we have an opposition, it doesn't have to be Labour, it could be a fractured Labour or Labour meets Lib Dems or whatever, we aren't going to see any improvement. And I fear for the, yeah, what can you call it? It's populism, it is sort of nationalistic, it's aggressively anti-immigrant. The stuff we're hearing from the Tories is deeply distasteful, but there's no consequence for having that, for espousing those values.
This is quite depressing. Can we talk about the fight now?
Please, we do have to give it its due consideration.
Okay, Do you want to explain what happened?
I want your analysis of the fight.
Okay,
Steve.
Right.
It's the closest we'll ever get to having a sports program.
So this is what happened, right? The UK Independence Party, which essentially has done what it wanted to.
It's won.
It's got Britain out of Europe. Its leader Nigel Farage stepped down. For a second time, but yeah, he stepped down. He said he's gone.
Or apparently not.
But anyway, let's just say he stepped down. Right. They had a leadership election. It was won by a woman called Diane James. 18 days later, she says, you know what, actually, I don't want to do this. She steps down.
She's going to be an infuriating pub quiz question.
So she is. So that's the situation. Then a guy called Stephen Wolfe comes along and he says, right, I want to stand to be the new UKIP leader. Oh, by the way, I actually rather like Theresa May. And last weekend, I was talking to some Tories about possibly defecting. Anyway, forget about that. I want to be UKIP leader. The next day, there's a meeting of all the UKIP MEPs, of which Stephen Wolfe is one. One of them, a guy called Mike Hookham, is rather angry at the fact that Stephen Wolfe was talking about joining the Tories. This is a meeting in the morning.
Did he want to show Wolfe the door?
Yeah.
I worked on that for some time.
And you could have used something about Hookham as well,
exactly.
But we haven't. Anyway,
I rose above it.
10 o'clock in the morning, everyone's sober. They're having a... Well, we want to assume everyone's sober at 10 in the morning. Having a meeting. Wolfe and Hookham have an argument, which apparently ends with Wolfe saying, right, let's take this outside. He takes off his jacket. They go outside. By the way, this is happening in the European Parliament in Strasbourg. They fight... They grapple. We heard the little clip earlier about, you know, there was definitely no slapping or whatever, but apparently he was hit. Who knows quite what happens. Anyway, Wolfe falls over, hits his head. Everything's fine. But then an hour or so later, he collapses, goes to hospital. This is the guy that wants to be leader of UKIP saying, at 10 o'clock in the morning, let's go outside and finish it there. I mean, this is nuts.
That's how all clear the air meetings end, isn't it? But this is the thing, it's kind of beyond unedifying. And this is, I think, one of the problems we've got is, look, we're all talking slightly flippantly at times. Just look what we're talking about. MEPs, our representatives in what remains still, you know, the Parliament of Europe, and, you know, we're signed up for now to it, duking it out in the middle of the morning. I mean, it's shameful. Think with the derision we used to heap on those parliaments where you'd see people throwing their shoes at one another. Oh, how funny it is. Another scrap in the
Ukraine
parliament in Ukraine.
The Taiwanese are good value for this, I have to say.
This is what we've descended to. It's shameful.
It's embarrassing.
Andrew, as a music journalist, I put this to you. UKIP is Guns N' Roses. Farage is Axl Rose. Debate.
It's a makeable case. They can't really hold it together without him, and yet they can't stand him. I mean, you can stand that one up, I think.
Will he grow cornrows?
Well, he did flaunt the moustache for a bit. Axl Rose also went through a moustache phase.
Interesting. Can I just point out one other thing about this whole sorry saga at the European Parliament? And that is, this is a genuine quote from a UKIP MEP talking about Stephen Wolfe this morning, saying he is sick of croissants and he's looking forward to a good full English breakfast. Let's just remind ourselves, the French doctors and nurses have looked after, have given care and sustenance to Stephen Wolfe.
Apparently in the form of croissants.
And what does his party do? Turn around and say, bloody French with their croissants. I mean, it just sums it up.
I know. The trouble is there has been an increasing difficulty in the last months, but especially this week, in trying to make fun of the actual news, because basically all you have to do is read out what happened and nothing you can come up with is actually any funnier. We are going to take, on that happy note, a short break. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up next, the UK counts, US rather. The US, not the UK. The US, they're becoming difficult to tell apart. The US counts seconds out, round two.
The freshly minted Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining is a handbook for people who enjoy honest, locally made food. It's also about the other, sometimes overlooked elements that make a great meal. Honed hosting skills, getting the light right, and owning the sharpest kitchen kit. As well as offering up our favorite restaurants, bars and cafes from Adelaide to Zurich, the world's freshest markets, shops and most inspiring producers. It's also a book for people who want to turn their love of food into their livelihood. Hungry for more? We thought you might be. The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining is published by Gestalten and available now from monocle.com/shop. or at any good bookshop.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tom Edwards, Henry Rees Sheridan, and we do now have Ed Stocker, I believe. And while the UK continues to hop about shrieking in the manner of someone who has shot themselves in the foot, the US continues to fondle the trigger, sights trained on one shoe, wondering what would happen if. This Sunday sees the second presidential debate between Democrat Hillary Clinton and her orange Republican rival Donald Trump. The latter will be hoping to improve on the first debate, in which he was roundly thrashed and then sought to console himself by sitting up all night tweeting abuse at beauty pageant contestants. Ed, I will ask you first, do we imagine Trump will be better prepared this time?
Well, I think he has to be, doesn't he? He couldn't exactly be worse prepared than he was in that first debate at Hofstra University on Long Island. Apparently, he is going to be doing some prepping today and over the weekend before Sunday's debate. He did hold a sort of town hall style event in New Hampshire last night. Having said all of that, I mean, it wasn't exactly a grueling experience in that town hall. He'd seen the questions in advance, and the person asking the questions was a rather, conservative radio host. So he had a lot on his side. But I think, as you were saying before, as is widely, deemed to be the case, he lost that first debate pretty badly. And he hasn't had a good week or 10 days now of headlines, not just his tweeting, his going on social media related to Alicia Machado. Also, several newspapers beginning to dig into both his taxes and some of his other business practices. So I guess he's hoping for what they love to call here in the US on TV, a reset. He's hoping that a stronger performance on Sunday night will kind of reframe his whole hopes of reaching the White House, Andrew.
Well, Ed, we do know that he does have a new idea for one demographic he might be able to appeal to. Here is Trump speaking earlier.
I say kiddingly, but I mean it. I don't care how sick you are. I don't care if you just came back from the doctor and he gave you the worst possible prognosis, meaning it's over. You won't be around in 2 weeks. Doesn't matter. Hang out till November 8th. Get out and vote. And then all we're going to say is, we love you and we will remember you always. Get out and vote.
So, Ed, his big new pitch is to people who don't have to care about the consequences.
Well, he's already lost, he's lost the Latino vote. He's polling, I think, Hillary Clinton gets at least 95%. I think that figure's probably higher now of the black vote. So, now he's targeting a new demographic. Obviously, that was slightly tongue-in-cheek. But he wants people to get out and vote. He, at this stage, he needs all the votes he can get. So, I wonder if we'll see a calmer Donald Trump on Sunday. I mean, the point, I think, really, is that, what we've seen is, despite reshuffling his kind of inner circle so many times already, you think, that he's been reined in. And then he goes on a kind of rampage on social media, which clearly no one in his inner circle would have wanted him to do. It shows that he is essentially kind of rogue. And you saw from those opening moments at Hofstra University in that first televised debate, he seemed to be quite calm. It was quite even a stilted affair at the beginning. He looked vaguely presidential. Then it lasted, 2 minutes, 5 minutes?
Well,
and then barely, we saw the old Trump.
Barely even that. Well, to come back to you, Tom Edwards, with that point, for Donald Trump at this point, his numbers are heading towards the Earth's core at a rate of knot, rather encouragingly. He's well behind in Florida and North Carolina, which he desperately needs. What makes more sense for him on Sunday night, to try and do the calm, reasonable presidential thing, or just think, screw it and go full Trump?
Maybe a few more of those really hilarious terminal illness gags. I mean, it's a happy hunting ground, surely. That way the popular vote lies, or perhaps not. I mean, I'd like to think that it's so manifestly obvious that he stands no chance that it doesn't matter whether he comes out dressed in a comedy ringmaster's outfit or plays it dead straight in presidential. The problem we've got is, and I think we've talked about this before, Andrew, he appeals to a demographic which has been rather unchanging, which seems to endorse him with more enthusiasm each time he stoops to a new low.
Did he succeed because of this stuff, not despite it?
You know, Donald Trump really doesn't give a shit. Look at how much he doesn't care. Look, he tried to avoid paying his taxes. Yeah, well, I wouldn't pay my taxes either. You know, he denies things he's just said. He denies that he said them. And people say, oh, I like this about the guy. You know, he doesn't care what people think. And so my worry is that there's still a very committed core who are going to vote for him. But I think, yeah, in terms of the actual niceties of the debate, I'm certainly hoping that, you know, that horse has bolted.
Well, finally tonight, we should conclude our survey of an eventful week by considering the diplomatic incident which embroiled Australia and Malaysia, but which mercifully and with consummate political skill on both sides was resolved short of armed conflict. I refer, of course, to what became known as the Budgie Nine, the gaggle of Australian halfwits who celebrated the excellent victory of their and my countryman Daniel Ricciardo in the Malaysian Grand Prix, rather, by disrobing to reveal underwear patterned after the Malaysian flag. Henry, I will allow you on this one occasion to generalise at will about the boorishness of my country folk, but how is it possible for reasonably grown adults to be this ignorant in this day and age?
I am most interested in the flag aspect of the vexillological angle of this story, because I think that one of the formal charges that was brought against him was desecration of the flag or something tantamount.
It was something of that in that vicinity, yes.
To that. Now, I'm not sure if, for example, I was in my locale in Swansea, I saw a group of foreigners on the beach stripped down to reveal a Welsh flag, Speedo, beneath their clothes. I'm not sure if that would offend me more, or do you know what I mean? I think that I would actually be quite proud.
Speaking as an Australian, were a cohort of Malaysian tourists to strip to their underwear to reveal the Australian flag, I can't imagine that I could possibly care less. But this is where the question lies. Does one, Tom, when in Rome, have to recognise that the Romans find different things offensive?
Well, yeah, I think there's a common sense angle here. I don't know. It's rather complicated. The countries that have these quite strict lèse-majesté laws and all this kind of thing about whether it be about a royal family or
there's a few visitors to Thailand have discovered.
Well, exactly. And then there's much more extreme examples about respecting local custom and legal practice. If we go into the Gulf area, for example, and foreigners still fall foul. And I think if you display that kind of gratuitous ignorance, and it's to an offensive level that I would associate with some of your lesser countrymen.
the British being renowned for their impeccable decorum when travelling abroad.
It is difficult. I rather feel that, yeah, budgie smugglers with the flag a problem. If they'd thrown maybe a corked hat in there, maybe this all would have dissipated quicker.
You think that would have somehow lessened the blow, the cork hat, because they would be parodying
there's
their own culture
situation
as well.
That is not improved with a
corked hat.
Corked hat, maybe at a jaunty angle.
And then which is why I would never broadcast one of these programmes without wearing mine.
Indeed.
Glad to see it. It's like an old friend.
Yeah, as I now am. I've had to get a bigger one to fit over the headphones, of course, but which does fall over my eyes from time to time. But
what kind of welcome?
Let
me turn the tables. What kind of welcome are the Budgie Nine going to get? I think it'll
be a hero's welcome.
A hero's welcome, and I think that will be almost as damning an indictment of contemporary Australia as well.
In Australia we do have, unfortunately, that sort of cohort of objectionable morons who think, you know, banter is funny, and they will think these guys are absolute ledgers. But I do think there are also quite a lot of people will kind of see straight through them for the gaggle of entitled private school yahoos they obviously are.
If it goes anything like politics in this country, I expect to see at least one of the Budgie Nine, probably in Frontline Politics within the fortnight.
Wouldn't surprise me in the least. On that happy thought, it is all we have time for today's Midori, on today's Midori House. The show was brought to you by a veritable hornet's nest of foreign workers coming over here and making your radio programs. Produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Luke Saunders. Our studio manager, Toby Hammond, I think is British, but we don't hold it against him. There's music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800. For now, thanks for listening. Goodbye.